been going over and spending that much money.
Okay, we will call to order the House Revenue Committee and welcome everybody here today for some public hearings on tax credit issues related to charitable giving and education. Lots of different things to talk about today. We'll begin with a public hearing on House Bill 2521 and turn first to the estimable Ed Waters, if he'll tell us what it's about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2521 creates an income tax credit for scholarships provided by employers for their employees. Credit is 50% of the scholarships funded up to $50,000 per employer per year, and it has a five-year carry forward. Requires certification of each employer's scholarship program and also the credit amount. Certification occurs via the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. The bill also directs the commission to adopt rules determining the eligibility and program details, and the language of the bill places a $1 million cap on the total amount of credits that can be certified by the commission in a calendar year. The credit is available beginning the 2002 tax year.
Okay. Representative Hass, why don't we have you speak to this first?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have an overhead presentation that I'd want to show you here. Imagine your child comes home one day and hands you a report card that looks like this. Understandably, you're disappointed. We all want our kids to do well. So how do you think children should respond when they see our report card that has the exact same grade? Yes, these are Oregon's grades handed out by the National Center for Public Policy and Higher Education. Notice the D-minus next to affordability on its way to an F. Our record for helping high school students get into college is shameful. Over the last 10 years, tuition for Oregon's public universities has grown by almost 90%, and as a result, Oregon has dropped to 43rd in per capita spending on higher ed. When you factor in cost of living, we fall to the fifth least affordable state for those seeking to enter higher education. So we've reached a milestone here, Mr. Chairman, that I don't think you should be proud of, that we will be the first generation where it's harder for us to send our kids to college than it was for our parents. House Bill 2521 is simply an attempt to create some financial incentives for businesses to create scholarships for their employees and their employees' kids. It offers a 50% tax credit to businesses that set up scholarship funds through the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. So for every dollar the state holds up as a carrot, businesses have to kick in $2 to help with someone's college education. By way of background, a few years ago, I set up a small scholarship fund on my own for journalism majors, and the Oregon Student Assistance Commission administers it. I'm also a trustee on the Tom Dargan Scholarship Fund. He's the pioneer broadcaster who founded KATU Television, so I've learned a little bit about this subject and the amazing changes that scholarships make in someone's life. I've also learned that college is still out of reach for an astonishing number of high school graduates. As a member of this committee, I'm in a fairly unique position to understand what tax credits are all about. I understand that big, thick book that lists all those tax credits. I was on the floor today when we argued about the cost of these, and I know the budget realities we face. So first, let me say this credit has a statutory cap of $1 million, and the Student Assistance Commission estimates the cost at far less than that. Second, this credit does what many others do not, in that it leverages private money to help pay for higher education. So, in summary, this bill will not make up the $96 million the higher ed community is asking for in restored budget cuts. It does, however, encourage business to take a greater role in producing highly educated graduates that our industries and our economy depends on. And, Mr. Chairman, I note that there are some co-sponsors of this bill on our committee. If you want to move into work session directly from here, it'd be fine with me.
Oh, look at that. It only says public hearing on the agenda.
Oh.
Also, University of Oregon President David Frohnmayer was to speak on this. He sends a letter in support. With your permission, Mr. Chairman, I do want to add an amendment that limits this to businesses of 250 employees and fewer. There are many other people here who have some thoughts on this. Dexter Johnson is standing by in the wings for some technical support on questions that we may need.
Well, thank you, Representative Hass. We have some witnesses to hear from, and then Dexter wants to listen live, so if you can raise your hand if you need to cough up and explain something. Let's hear from Cheryl Kirchhoff. First.
Ready.
Welcome.
Welcome, thank you, and good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Kirchhoff. I'm on the staff at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. As you probably know, at the commission, we have many duties. We guarantee federal student loans, we deliver Oregon Need Grant funds, and we also administer more than 200 privately funded scholarship programs. This year in the scholarship arena, we awarded $7.2 million to 3,000 students. Colleges and universities also provide grants and scholarships, and students apply for other scholarships they find with the help of their high school and college counselors and on the World Wide Web. The result of this is a patchwork quilt of aid that helps students pay for college. The biggest piece of that quilt is student loans. Almost 60% of student aid is now in the form of loans. And as you can imagine, student debt is increasing proportionately. For instance, at Southern Oregon State University, Southern Oregon University, the average amount of student loan debt at the time of graduation is $21,000 and growing. The commission asks today for your support for House Bill 2521, a plan to leverage state funds with private donations or scholarships. By offering small Oregon businesses a 50-cent tax credit for every dollar the business invests in a scholarship program for their employees and employee dependents, new partnerships can be formed to help Oregon students pay for college or technical training beyond high school. Partnerships can help to alleviate that growing debt burden, and I might add that in the 1999 academic year, Oregonians borrowed for college $530 million. The partnerships can help the struggle that low and moderate income families face in paying tuition, and it can also help reduce the number of hours that students must work, often to the detriment of their educational experience. The Commission currently partners successfully with bank trust divisions, with unions, credit unions, and associations. We also celebrate our partnership with individual donors like Representative Hass and with foundations including the Ford Family Foundation and the Oregon Community Foundation. The Commission looks forward to helping Oregon businesses establish scholarship programs and helping to contribute to an increase in the proportion of Oregonians with college degrees. According to the Oregonian earlier this year, January 13th, Oregon sustained its booming high-tech economy during the 1990s by importing educated workers. As economies improved elsewhere, the flow of newcomers slowed. Consequently, Oregonians with a college degree remained at 29%, the same level as 4 years ago. The word partnership implies that all participants benefit. Oregon benefits when private and public sectors collaborate to strengthen our educational assets. And I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to speak on behalf of House Bill 2521.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Kirchhoff?
I'd like to introduce Louise McGarry, who is the owner of McGarry Machine Company, a company in Portland with 86 employees, and she is currently an employer who provides scholarship program for her employee dependents.
Ms. McGarry.
I've used this scholarship program for about 5 years. I found the Scholarship Commission to be very helpful in taking off an administrative burden that would be too much for a company to handle, that without them we probably would not have put this type of scholarship into play. They, for a very reasonable fee of $500 a year, administer our scholarships. It's a very popular plan with our employees, and when it's very difficult to get highly skilled employees, this is a fine method of retaining your employees. This is just something that came out of my heart. I mean, I'm not even a college graduate, and I'm president of a very successful company. 30 years ago, I was awarded a scholarship from the state, and then it was taken away from me because my dad worked in giving to poorer people. They kind of changed the criteria, and that's always been kind of a real problem for me to digest, and I guess that was my motivation for starting this sort of plan, because I felt like our machinists and welders, you know, an average machinist and welder is $45,000 to $50,000 a year that we employ, and they probably would not qualify for scholarships for their children. So we felt that this would be a very good benefit to provide to our employees, and it's very, very popular. There really aren't very many ways of having any abuse. It's because there's IRS law that really restricts, you know, how these are given out, and our employees are restricted to only 10% of the applicants. So we can usually only give about one employee a scholarship, and the dependents have a larger chance of getting a scholarship. I don't really think there's any abuses in the program. I can't believe more companies don't do this. It really surprises me. I think maybe they don't know about it. And I think the tax incentive would be a real plus to get more people to use this benefit, you know, for their employees. And I think that it really would be helpful. And
Questions?
I have one. You said you're providing these scholarships. That's how you're working through this disappointment from 30 years ago.
Yeah.
But with no tax incentive, is there currently any tax benefit to you as an employer in this?
Well, I'm a C corporation. Mm-hmm. Now, there's some real issues on a C versus an S.
Sure.
And because I'm a C corporation, it's an advantage to me when I have a good year, and I do this with my donations. I'm just a charitable person, and so I have an advantage there in that I can get the deduction. And I also don't contribute as much if I have a poor year. You know, 98 was a real bad year for us, and I didn't, you know, participate or put funds in. So I can put more funds in on my better years. But I would do more if I had a credit.
I guess I didn't realize that the Student Assistance Commission worked this way. You act as an administrator for
correct
all of these, Representative Hass's scholarship and these others. So
correct
then when Ms. McGarry makes a contribution, it's actually a contribution to the Student Assistance Commission, is that it?
Correct.
Or
state of Oregon.
To the state. That's why you get the charitable deduction.
You're
not making it to your own scholarship,
right,
making it to the state, and then you administer it according to terms that you've negotiated with the grantor, the person that creates this.
Correct, Mr.
That's
Chairman,
right.
And according to IRS regulations, it's
very stated.
Yeah,
sure.
Sometimes we disagree, but they rule. Mm-hmm. And also, they do a fine job. I didn't realize that they use volunteers, and it's that they have quite a volunteer segment to keep the fees real small, and they just do an excellent job. And she was, you know, I hadn't even realized that. I thought the state was subsidizing this, and actually she's within her budget and doing a great job for business, and more people should know about this.
Well, we do. That's very good. Any questions? Representative Bates.
I signed on to this bill primarily to raise the debate, okay, and that debate's what we're seeing here today. And I appreciate Representative Hass bringing it forward. What I wanted to know is a few more details about this. An employer puts money into the plan, and then that employees become eligible for the money, I assume, and they go through you. Is there a means test? I mean, are we subsidizing high-income families, or with low-income families, or middle-income families? How do you go about distributing the funds?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates,
We use the federal information to determine need. In fact, our administrative rules require that all applicants complete the federal application, the free application for federal student aid. So in each of the applicant pools that we establish for each of the 200 programs, students are competing within that applicant pool. Many donors set a limit on the amount of family contribution for which a student can be awarded. So over the last 5 years, 65% of our scholarship recipients have also been NEED grant eligible. And NEED grant is determined on 75% of the median federal poverty level. So 65% of our scholarship recipients have been NEED grant eligible, and I think that indicates a large level of need. So we're determining, the decisions are made at the commission as to who receives these scholarships. It can't be decided by the company. It has to be decided by an outside entity, and that's been our role in that.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
But one of the criteria for getting a scholarship is that they be an employee or dependent of an employee for that company. Is that correct?
Correct.
What tends to happen is sometimes the employees that I have, I've had situations where I have like younger intern employees, very, very sharp. They get shot out and only the best one fits in the 10%. And what happens is the dependents seem to get more. They qualify for 90%, so they get it. And what happens is quite often they're need-based too. And what happens is I'm giving a scholarship, and now the state doesn't have to because mine goes first. And I've seen that happen, you know, with some of our maybe, you know, shipping, receiving area or accounting department help where they're, you know, I've got quite a few Vietnamese, and they have a lot of kids, and they kind of take, you know, they're more qualified for 90%, so I'm saving the state of Oregon money. And I think if you expand on this, you'll see more of that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much, both of you. Appreciate your testimony. Gary Carlson, Julie Brandis. Sure. Gary, we welcome you back. Julie, I don't think we've seen you in revenue this session.
This session.
All right. Your debut.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Gary Carlson with Associated Oregon Industries, and Julie Brandis, our education specialist on our staff, is with me today. As you know, AOI represents approximately 20,000 businesses across the state of Oregon. And education is something that we care a great deal about, and I'm going to ask Julie in a couple of minutes to walk through some of those activities that we've had over the years with you, just so you know the extent of our background on the subject. We do want to commend Representative Haas for bringing this bill in. Many of our employers, I think, do take an interest in the educational levels, achievement of their employees, and do, in fact, assist them with the expenses of that educational achievement. We have done this in our own office for many, many years for employees who want to improve themselves in a way that it benefits themselves and the organization. And I think that this credit concept will help stimulate additional involvement in higher educational achievement and working with employers to try to make that happen. So with that, I'd like to ask Julie to go over the material she had distributed to you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries. AOI has a long history of involvement with education initiatives and activities. We handed out a list of the activities since 1969. Just to talk about one, we tried to provide scholarships to the UCLA Graduate School of Business to principals who would be implementing the Education Reform Act. What we learned is that principals are well-trained in running schools, but they weren't well-trained in implementing comprehensive change. And so we had the Anderson Graduate School of Management come up to Oregon for a week in the summer, two summers, and work with principals and teachers to put together a comprehensive change plan for individual schools. And that was one of my favorite programs, so that's why I mention it at this point. As for this bill, The 1996 AOI Education Task Force asked, which included many of our board members and longstanding members in AOI, asked staff to pursue additional access opportunities. In other words, to continue to pursue ideas in the legislature that increase the number of students enrolled in college. Many of you are familiar with our Student Bill of Rights, which is another attempt to get more students involved with higher education. Many of our employers already are involved with assisting students paying with their paying tuition, or their if it's not an employee, it's an employee's child. So they're in the habit of working with their employees and their children to pursue incentives to get them into college. I think this is a we think this is great idea to expand the these opportunities. This credit will encourage employers to provide and expand scholarship and tuition assistance programs. So we are in full support of this legislation.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Carlson and Ms. Brandis, Representative Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Either Julie or Gary, is it your anticipation from reading this bill that this would, first of all, only apply to higher education?
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct? And secondly, it would apply to both public and private higher education institutions?
I believe that's correct, Dr. White.
I think there's a certain discretion relative to rules that's given to the scholarship commission here. Is there any reason to believe that that would be in any way restricted, or that it would likely would apply to public and private institutions of higher education?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I assumed it would apply to public and private, but perhaps someone more familiar with the Student Assistance Commission could answer that question more directly.
You want to bring Ms. Kirchhoff back up and ask her then?
Yeah, well, the other question I had, Mr. Chairman, is would it apply to institutions both in the state and out of the state?
Again, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm not familiar enough with the bill, but I know full well that our members, AOI members, who provide scholarship assistance programs to currently are doing it for students who are going out of state. So I think the idea would be to continue on. But, of course, Representative Hass wrote the bill, so he might be more familiar with that.
Yeah, I think, well, as I see it, it provides that the commission would do that, would establish that by rule.
Mr. Chairman, the intent was to open it to institutions in and outside the state if they're accredited.
Okay.
By the national
public state. And private in and outside of the state.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If I can follow up, and maybe Representative Hass is the right one to answer this, or what his intent was here. Do you envision any restrictions here relative to financial need, academic merit, or is this simply open to all students irrespective of academic achievement or economic need?
My intent is, and I think it's in there, and Dexter can help me, but the idea is that the business that has this that funds a scholarship sets the criteria. So
that the business sets the criteria?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything else? Anything for these witnesses? Representative Bates.
Didn't we just hear that the criteria is set by the commission, and that is a means test? I was missing part of the conversation here.
I think it was relative to Ms. McGarry's, but...
That was the same question that Representative Witt, I think, asked. Was there's a means test for the most part for the people getting the scholarships through the commission, right? The money's...
That is how it works out.
Right, right.
But that is not a requirement.
But it has to go through the commission.
Bates Doctor Clinic could set up a scholarship fund for students who major in the medicine, and for whatever criteria you want in there, and they administer it for you.
And in that administration, they follow federal guidelines, which do have some means testing in it.
Yes, you do have to follow the federal guidelines.
Yeah.
Well, let's proceed.
Was it?
Oh, what?
Follow up question.
Yeah, sure. To Representative Hass?
The Representative Hass, I suppose. Is it your intent?
You feel like you're in a tennis match, don't you?
Is it the intent of your legislation that I signed on to? That's never too late to make a fool of yourself. That tax dollars, which a credit is, would be flowing out of state to other institutions. I mean, if students can take this scholarship, even though it's only partially funded by the state, and leave the state with that money, I have some questions in my mind about that policy.
First of all, you know, Dr. Bates, you and I are on the same team, right?
Yeah, and we share an apartment. I don't want a knife in my chest some dark night.
If you'd like, you'd have this conversation out in the hall.
Yeah. Well, it does do that. I would just make one comment, Mr. Chairman, in that the tax dollars flow to help mostly Oregon high school graduates, whether they're going to Harvard, whether they're going to OSU.
And I guess that's the policy decision to make.
It is a policy decision.
Yeah, and that's why we have the hearings, to air these things. That's good. Now, I want to thank you, too, for witnessing this change, maybe even instigating it. It was helpful. And let's bring up John Wyckoff from the Student Association.
Comes the dash one for me.
Mr. Wyckoff, welcome.
I don't want to be
Chairman Shetterly, members of the committee, thanks for this opportunity. OSA supports House Bill 2521 because it's a good, it seems like a good approach to providing more access to post-secondary education. I should point out that the Oregon Student Association is basically opposing most tax credits and tax cuts that are out there for education, not because we don't like them. Many of these programs we like a lot. We think they're good ideas. But in the overall context of a very tight budget, most of these we are just staying away from or opposing. However, this one we are putting our support behind because it seems to have the ability to leverage private dollars through public dollars and putting more money into the system, and we like that. We think that gives students more opportunities, and this seems to be a fairly creative approach to putting more money into providing access for students. I want to talk quickly. And the one point I really want to make is about student debt, because we tend to support any program that may alleviate students' reliance on student loans and which really hampers them after they get out of school. And the first point I want to make there is that, and to give a little background, that in 1975, a typical student, their financial aid package would be composed 75% of grant aid and about 25% of loan aid. Today, that's the opposite. The vast majority of a student's financial aid package comes from loans. In the graph that we have here, this is about a 10-year-old study, so it is a bit older, but I would argue that this hasn't changed. If anything, this has gotten worse since then. But you can see here how when you have two students who take $10,000 in loans, which some folks will say is the average, though we see folks coming out with much higher loans, and I think $10,000 is probably a low figure. But for a student who takes $10,000 in loans, you can see how their participation in the economy goes. Basically, for about 10 or 15 years, their participation in the economy is to pay loans, and not a whole lot more. This is the down payment on your house and all the other things that you want to do and that you went to college to be able to have money to get. And we see that as a real problem for students once they get out of school. They're just not able to do those things and to have those opportunities that folks who didn't have to take loans have. The usual argument seems to go that once you graduate from college, you have higher earning potential and you're able to pay back these loans. But we would argue that for a lot of folks coming out of school, the social workers, the teachers, the nonprofit lobbyists, there are a lot of folks who just simply can't afford to pay those loans and do much of anything else. So we just simply wanted to make that point to you today, and we see this as a good approach to helping alleviate what we see as a growing reliance on loans for students. And like I said, we are supportive of programs like this, though in this budget, in the context of the budget we're in, you're not going to see us up here supporting very many of these programs, though this is one of the very, very few that we are supporting. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Chairman. Yes, Representative Beck, is that you?
Yep, this is I. John, is this trend national, or is Oregon's, Oregon map?
No, it's a national trend.
National trend.
Though in Oregon, I would probably say it could be worse than Oregon. I mean, if you look at that National Center for Public Policy and Higher Education study, mm-hmm. Oregon, when you look at, you can't take just tuition, but if you look at median incomes, tuition, and financial aid opportunities, we don't look very good. Mm-hmm. And so students are having to take, very large loans.
I would just be curious if you ever could document how even more askew, if it's true, how more askew we are on this trend than...
Yeah, this is a national one, and I couldn't tell you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mike Sherlock.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike Sherlock, and I'm here today representing the Pacific Automotive Trades Association. And
Mr. Chair, I thought he was going to talk about divorcement, so I'm really relieved.
Well, we could do that. How about self-service? Today we got a separate client here. This is the Pacific Automotive Trades Association, which are independent repair garages. And our understanding of this, and I may be wrong here after hearing some of the previous discussion, but our understanding of this is that this type of tax credit would apply for tuition for community colleges. Is that correct?
Well, I think we'll bring Ms. Kirchhoff back up to kind of ask that line of questions when we get done with the other testimony. Right now, it looks to me like it directs the Student Assistance Commission to adopt rules to define the types of educational institutions. So that's open right now, but we'll... Okay. Keep going.
Well, assuming that this applies to community colleges, our interest is that we have a severe shortage of automotive technicians in the marketplace. You remember back in the old days when every high school had a automotive technician or class, you know, auto tech, where the kids would learn how to work on cars. And many of those kids went on to become the professional technicians that work on people's cars. Those programs have pretty well dried up. Very few of the high schools have those kinds of programs anymore. Consequently, that type of training now is almost always obtained through either on-the-job training, which isn't the best type of training, or through community colleges. And many of the community colleges have really excellent programs. The problem is the kids that are steered to that type of training many times do not have the financial resources to pay tuition to go there. And so we have a real problem with that. A lot of our members currently pay for tuition for their technicians to get better training, and we would like to expand that. And we believe that if this passes, and assuming that it applies to the community college portion of the market, that the consumers are going to be a lot better off, the employers are going to be a lot better off, and the employees would be a lot better off. The quality of auto repair would go up if this passed and it applied to community colleges. Any questions?
Any questions? All right, thank you very much. You stick around, we'll find out the answers to some of these questions. But let me recess this hearing for just a few minutes here, or however long it takes. Representative Close is here to speak to her HJR. I think that's the right. Is that the right one? Okay. Then let me recess. We will come back and finish the testimony on House Bill 2521. So don't go away. And I'll open a public hearing on HJR 2 and invite Representative Close. Maybe you want to give us the background on that.
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. HJR 2 proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution allowing the legislature to create tax expenditures for amounts paid as tuition and fees to public and private schools. Under the current Article 1, Section 5 of the Oregon Constitution, the legislature is prohibited from endorsing or allowing those kinds of transactions.
All right, Representative Close, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Federley and members of the House Committee on School Funding and Tax Fairness. I appreciate you taking my testimony. I have to leave at 3 o'clock. I'm riding with the State Patrol today.
Yeah.
So, should be an interesting afternoon. I'm Betsy Close, State Representative from District 36. House Joint Resolution 2 proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution to allow the legislature to create a tax credit or a deduction for contributions that families make to an education investment account. This bill and House Bill 2091, which is the Family Education Account Bill, were written together. House Bill 2091 defines this account and what would be eligible education expenses. Included in House Bill 2091 are public elementary and secondary expenses, homeschooling expenses, and higher education costs such as tuition, room and board, teaching supplies for homeschoolers, athletic fees, banner music fees, standardized test fees, tutoring expenses are some examples. House Bill 2091 is designed to advance parental choice in education, thereby improving our educational system through competition. And in that bill, we have left the amount blank, but have suggested a $2,500 per tax year could be invested. Introduced House Joint Resolution 2 in response to questions about whether House Bill 2091 is constitutional, since the Oregon Constitution prohibits using money from the Treasury for private purposes. However, the point should be made that a tax credit is never in the state treasury. The tax money would be retained by the taxpayer in order that the parents can direct this educational money to the school that best fits the needs of their child and to services and expenses that they are many times already paying for educational purposes. At the federal level, federal dollars are regularly used in higher education in the form of Pell Grants that can be used at the student's choice of school, public or private. So it is being done at the federal level. In the state of Michigan, an interesting related plan has been proposed. The case at hand involves the Universal Transfer Tax Credit, a plan proposed by the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. Under the UTTC, any Michigan taxpayer, whether an individual or corporation, can claim a dollar-for-dollar tax credit against the state income tax, single business tax, or the 6-mil state education property tax for tuition paid on behalf of a public or non-public K-12 student. This gives parents, especially low-income parents, greater ability to choose the best school for their children. With a tax credit, the taxpayer pays tuition for a student at a public or non-public school, and when he calculates his taxes, he subtracts the amount paid in tuition, subject to a maximum limit of 50% of what public schools receive per student, from his tax liability. The state is not involved in writing checks or selecting the school. The taxpayer, having already made the funding of education a priority, is simply allowed a portion of the taxes he pays to support the school system he does use. And similar programs are being considered at the federal level on an ongoing basis, and that's where I got my idea, was from federal legislation in the past that had not gone through. My legislation, HJR 2, lays the groundwork for the state of Oregon to extend to our citizens, our parents, an opportunity to be an active part of their children's education, investing their hard-earned cash on behalf of their kids. To ensure the constitutionality of HB 2091, I request this committee to pass HJR 2 to the voters to approve or reject the concept of education tax credits at the next regular general election. Thank you, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Questions, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, why do you think it's necessary to change the Constitution to achieve your purpose? I know at the federal level that the Supreme Court has made a distinction between the expenditure of public dollars and the expenditure of taxpayer dollars. And it seems to me in the substantive part of what you're trying to accomplish here, you're simply providing a tax deduction or a tax credit. So really you're talking about a taxpayer's dollars, not public dollars.
Chair Shetterly, Representative Witt, I'm in agreement with you. I do not feel that we need to do this. However, our attorney, Mr. Johnson, disagreed with me on that, and he advised that we should have this companion legislation.
Dexter? He's here.
Is he?
Yeah.
Oh, he broke his record. I mean, he didn't even have to time it that time.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair and members, good afternoon. This is a complicated area where you need to consider both the federal constitution and the state constitution. And at the federal level, a tax credit that is used to support private sectarian educational institutions is probably okay. In fact, there are some federal cases that have upheld state tax credits for that use. In Oregon, as Ed mentioned, there is Section 5, Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution, which prohibits the state from taking money out of the state treasury for religious institutions. And there's a Oregon Supreme Court case that has interpreted that provision very broadly to, for example, prohibit the state supplying school textbooks to parochial schools. The Oregon Supreme Court has not directly considered whether a tax credit is a is prohibited under this section, but they have interpreted that provision broadly, and as you are all aware, a tax credit is economically an expenditure of state monies for the purpose for which the tax credit is created. And so that is why it's my opinion that the best way to achieve the result you want is to have the voters adopt an amendment to that provision, such as is suggested in HJR 2.
I guess it is helpful to understand that we do have a different provision in the Oregon Constitution than what is in the federal Constitution, and the Oregon courts always interpret the Oregon Constitution. We go to the Oregon Constitution first, I guess, in addressing constitutionality of statutes, and so it's critical that we understand where the Oregon courts would be on this under the Oregon Constitution.
Yes, that is correct, Mr. Chair. For a bill like this to pass muster, it must be okay under both the federal and state constitution, and the Oregon courts will look at the state constitution first.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dexter, do we have any cases that are on point? That textbook case doesn't seem like it's on point at all, because you're using public dollars to purchase the textbooks and then delivering them to a religious school. That's a very different tax situation than simply providing a tax credit or a tax deduction. By the way, a tax credit or a tax deduction which can be used for a religious or for a non-sectarian school. So are there any cases that are really on point?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, there is no Oregon case that has held that a tax credit is used for tuition or other expenses at a private sectarian school is prohibited, but it's my opinion that that is simply a form over substance kind of argument between a tax credit and a direct expenditure.
In your opinion, it gets back to what we call a tax expenditure?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, he's not persuaded.
No, I'm not persuaded. I'm not persuaded on two points. Number one, you can make an argument all kinds of things are tax expenditures. It's simply the way the legislature decided to craft the tax code, you know, which is its prerogative under the Constitution. So I'm really not necessarily persuaded on that point. But on the other point, I'm not persuaded is that this would be, I think as Representative Close describes it, this would be a provision that would allow tax credits for contributions to religious or non-religious educational institutions. So the person making the election here is the taxpayer. There's no legislative intent here to use public dollars in any way that I see, to use public dollars to further a religious education.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, that would be the argument that you would make. And
let's vote.
This is ultimately a policy choice at this point. But there certainly is a high risk that it could be declared unconstitutional.
This probably isn't fair to in this kind of colloquy here. Have you done a written opinion on this?
Mr. Chair, I have, yeah.
Okay. And if Representative Close would authorize it, you could even release that to the committee.
Chair Shetterly, I would be happy to. It was done last session. This bill was actually brought forward last session, so it has been some time.
That's fine. We can
need to be updated.
I guess one question I would have, and I understand the argument about the tax expenditure constituting, you know, the equivalent, I guess, of an appropriation. But let me ask, currently, contributions to religious institutions, churches in particular, but in a charitable or religious institution, are allowed a deduction from income tax. I guess, so what's the constitutional distinction between a tax credit and a tax deduction?
Now, Mr. Chair, there's no distinction.
So we're in trouble on the deductions, or?
Well, it would be... It seems to me there is a distinction between where you are permitted a tax benefit for a broad class of activities, simply making a contribution to any charity, and versus a payment where you are receiving a benefit in exchange, that is tuition or fees or whatever, and ultimately the payment that you are making is going to be compensated from the state in the form of a tax credit. That is the distinction, I believe.
Okay. Chair Shetland? Yes. I might just add that since we brought this bill forth, the Arizona Supreme Court has dealt with this issue. We have a different constitution.
Right, right.
However, that was sort of the landmark case that dealt with this issue.
But I'd ask Dexter, the Oregon wouldn't even look at the Arizona Constitution, would it? Or would it?
Well, Mr. Chair, the one thing that is interesting there, the amendment in question, this is actually a... This is Section 1, Article, Section 5, Article 1, is a provision that is in many state constitutions, and it's called the, has a kind of a generic name called the Blaine Amendment. It is in the Arizona Constitution as well.
Okay.
That court did uphold a statutory program where it's not quite like, as I recall, I haven't looked at 2091 in quite a while either, but not quite like that. It's more of a contribution to an intermediary organization that then can supply private sectarian schools with funds. It's not quite a direct credit for tuition or fees that are paid directly to the school. So it's a little different than this to begin with. But the other thing is, as I mentioned, that Blaine Amendment is in 20 to 30 state constitutions, and as far as I know, there's only the Arizona court that has upheld that.
And Chair Shelley,
yes.
I do have that decision if you're interested in looking at it.
We will. All right, any other questions for Representative Close or for Dexter? Thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you so much.
Anybody else? I won't go on with HDR2 for right now since we had some other witnesses waiting to testify on the other. So I will recess the public hearing on HJR2 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2521 and invite Johnny Lake to come forward. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Chairman Shetterly. My name is Johnny Lake, and I got asked to come as a voice of a student who has received a scholarship, and I am in support after reading of 2521 because I think it creates a partnership in our communities that's very needed. Many students in Oregon do not perceive themselves as having the opportunity to go to school, even the community college. I work with many students in high school who are A and B students, and outside their perspective is the fact that they can go to school here in their own state. And oftentimes the opportunity for a scholarship is the catalyst. It doesn't pay for the entire education, but oftentimes if they can get a scholarship, it sets them off on the right foot, and especially in our local community colleges, which tend to do an excellent job of preparing students for a four-year opportunity at a larger school. So I am in support of this bill because I think it sets up a great incentive in our communities for especially families who, many of our families still today, I think a lot of people are surprised, do not see their children as college candidates. Oftentimes in high school, they are advised that you're not college material. And so I think in dealing with these issues and especially preparing our children for the future, which I think is coming faster than most of us wanted to, these young people are going to have to be very prepared for the future. And I think there's not an option anymore. I think it used to be that you didn't have to go to college. You could go out and paint houses, or you could go out and lay brick, or you could go out and get a trade or a skill. But nowadays, even in those trades, it requires college preparation for young people to be able to do those jobs. So instead of it being an option for our kids, I think college is a requirement for all of our children. So whatever we can do, I think, to encourage our communities to support these children in pursuing some education great, after high school is only a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Light? All right, thanks very much for turning down.
Thank you.
Let me, before we wrap this up, invite Dexter back up if you Wood, and also Ms. Kirchhoff. Mr. V, could just tell us what the dash ones are about.
Mr. Chair, the dash one amendments limit the kinds of employers that can establish these scholarship programs to employers that have at least 4 full-time equivalent employees, but no more than 250 employees.
Okay. And they're on lines 21 through 24 at the bottom. There's a, what are those qualifications attached to?
That is, again, basically the only new text there is the must have at least 4, but no more than 250.
Okay.
The 1 million is from the...
Okay, from the bill. Thank you. Ms. Kirchhoff.
Yes.
There's questions here about whether this applies or would be applied to 4-year institutions, community colleges. I think the bill is not specific as to that. What would happen to this at the commission?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would refer you to the application booklet that has been distributed to you. If you look on page 2, that gives you a, some outline as to the fact that we are governed by administrative rules. So when we meet with prospective donors, Dexter happened to be a prospective donor, I would meet with him, I would have our administrative rules that say, you can tell me what your concerns are, what your desires are as far as where you'd like your students to be able to choose to go to college. Would you like them to be able to attend a 2-year or 4-year public-private college in Oregon, out of Oregon, as long as the college participates in the federal Title IV student financial aid programs, we can ship money there.
Well, let me ask just right there then, if the legislature is going to be creating this,
right,
then we're sort of sitting down at the table with you and we could make those selections too?
That seems reasonable. If you, for instance, you and your committee or the legislature determines that you would like the funds to stay in Oregon, that still meets the public good that we are...
Okay. And I'm not suggesting anything. It just helps us to know what the latitude is that we can define the parameter. We can at least some of the parameters around the scholarships.
Okay.
Right now, as it's drafted, it leaves it pretty much up to the commission, as I understand.
Up to the commission, Mr. Chairman, with using our administrative rules, they have to be U.S. citizens, Oregon residents, that sort of thing.
Does that answer everyone's question?
I just finished going tough for my kids, so I'm pretty aware of it. Okay.
Representative Witt.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just so I understand, I mean, would it be the intention to apply the same standards that exist now to the program that this bill would bring about? Or would you be looking at a new set of standards?
I think, again, Representative Witt, that would depend on what the legislature tells us in addition to our administrative rules. For instance, we have a definition... We have 8 programs right now, 8 companies that have these programs. 5 of them use merit only to determine who can apply. They still have to fill out this application. 3 others use merit and a need combination. Our administrative rules tell us that need is determined by the information on that FAFSA. But if the employer sitting down with me determines that they do not want to use need as a part of the criteria, we don't use it. We use merit. But the student still has to fill out the application, write the 2 essays, fill out the activities chart, submit their transcript. It's still competitive. I don't know if I'm answering.
Well, as I understand, I want to get back to what we can do in this committee then. Again, just for understanding what the limits are. We could amend this bill to make it a need-based only or merit and need, the same kind of choices that a grantor has in sitting down with you. We could specify 4-year or only, or 4-year and 2-year as long as the accreditation is there. And we could specify in-state, out-of-state. We could make those choices if we wanted to in the bill.
Mr. Chairman, that would be the relationship I would have with a donor.
Right.
You're the big donor.
Right. Is that your understanding, Dexter, that we could provide those specific limitations, or?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The only thing I would look at, and I'm not all that familiar with them is the IRS requirement.
Sure.
Right.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 2521? All right. Then I'll close the public hearing on that and open a public hearing on House Bill 2492. Ed. And while he is giving us the background, let me invite, let's see, Mr. Bunn, Mr. Christian, and Mr. Brooks, are you all together? No? Mr. Bunn. Christian, okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2492 creates an income tax credit for planned gifts to qualified charitable endowments. Credit amount is 50% of eligible planned gifts up to $10,000 credit. If credit is taken, charitable deduction, if any, must be reduced by the amount of the credit taken. Credit is available beginning of 2002 tax year through 2006 tax year. And finally, the Department of Revenue is directed to annually report on credit utilization and associated administrative costs for the years that the credit is in effect.
Okay. We have a dash one and dash two on this bill as well.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Mr. Bunn, Mr. Christian, whichever one of you wants to go first.
I'm going to start. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Gene Christian. Good afternoon. I am the Regional Director for Charitable Estate and Tax Planning Services for the Providence Health System in Oregon. I'm also the past president of the Northwest Plan Giving Roundtable, and it's on behalf of that organization that I testify today. Northwest Plan Giving Roundtable is a collection of some 160 professionals in the state of Oregon who are attorneys, accountants, trust officers, financial service providers, and nonprofit executives. These professionals are men and women, young and old, Caucasian, African American, Asian, conservative, and liberal, all working to secure donations through gift annuities, charitable trusts, and pooled income funds, which we also often refer to as charitable life income agreements. Together, Ken Bunn and I are here representing their collective support for the Endow Oregon Philanthropy Income Tax Credit, House Bill 2492. I've been in this business, which is also commonly referred to as planned giving, for more than 17 years, basically all of my adult working life. During that time, I've watched witnessed major federal tax reform at least four times, starting with the big tax code change in 1986, followed again in 92 and 94 and 97. As you know, taxation has always been and will always be a hot topic of debate at local, state, and national levels. Whether you're a proponent of larger, more active government or smaller, less invasive government, virtually all tax reform tends to take on the character of the political party in power at any given time. It's widely known and frankly accepted that taxation, at its core, is generally a partisan issue, with very few exceptions. I'm here today, based on my years of experience in this unique field of planned giving, to suggest that House Bill 2492 is one of those rare exceptions which can be embraced on a bipartisan basis. Why? Because it's fundamentally designed to lessen the tax burden for Oregonians, while at the same time it is designed to strengthen community service organizations which feed and shelter the poor and provide health and social services to citizens of Oregon. And it will do so in such a cost-efficient way that government simply could not replicate the net benefit on its own for the same projected net cost. Simply stated, for a very small amount of investment on your part, the return to our state over time would be unquestionably enormous. We recognize that elected officials in Oregon, based on recent economic forecasts, are now in an environment where huge budgetary issues loom on your horizon. Regardless of your political affiliation, we recognize that difficult decisions are inevitable in each of your immediate political futures. However, HB 2492 should be one of those areas of common ground in your upcoming deliberations. To date, we have yet to, actually, I shouldn't say this anymore, I met a guy today that was opposed to this this bill. I think he's going to testify later, but what I say here is to date, we have yet to find anyone closely associated with the bill that has a substantially negative position or feeling about it. HB 2492 is simply good public policy. If the economist's projections, Ed Waters' projections, hold true, some $12 million of tax savings will be garnered over the next 6 years by Oregonians who decide to create gift annuities, charitable trusts, or pooled income funds. That means that between $25 and $30 million would be added directly to the permanent coffers of charitable organizations in our state. In spite of the recent financial markets volatility, over time, that $25 to $30 million undoubtedly would increase in value. A portion of that growth would, in turn, be routinely taken from the corpus, the interest income harvested, if you will, to be used by a variety of charitable organizations, religious and non-religious alike, to directly combat everything from hunger and homelessness to the preservation of Oregon's natural resources, to the education of our next generation of leaders, to advancement in medicine that will one day eradicate many diseases which afflict Oregonians today. This proposed legislation is simple and fair, and yet profound and far-reaching at the same time. It's simple in that it's very easy for anyone to understand. And it's fair in that the size of the credit has exactly the same tax reduction benefit whether a person is young or old, rich or poor. It is profound because the revenue loss projections are very small, while providing tremendous perceived benefit in terms of potentially strengthening all Oregon communities. And finally, it is far-reaching because it gives each of you a chance to reach across political lines, embracing one another for the betterment of Oregonians in what promises to be an otherwise contentious period in our state's political history. You've got many big issues to face in the weeks and months to come. HB 2492 should not be a difficult decision. I encourage each of you to be sure HB 2492 is codified into law. Thanks for your time. I've enjoyed the chance to present. And if you have questions, I think we're going to take those at the end, but I want to yield the balance of my time or give my time now over to Ken Bunn.
Hello, my name is Ken Bunn. I've been in the insurance and estate planning field for 12 years, and 3 years ago I accepted the plan giving director position at Jesuit High School in Portland. During my 3 years at Jesuit, I have also been an active member in the Northwest Plan Giving Roundtable, and I am here representing both of those organizations today. This bill is important for all Oregonians. It is important to the religious community, to the educational community, and to other nonprofit organizations that provide needed and meaningful services to the community on a cost-effective and personalized basis. Although the upfront cost of this tax credit may be a burden in the current economic environment, the benefits of this bill are exactly what Oregonians need. It is important to remember that the tax credit will produce a lifetime of new income taxable retirement payments. It can free up assets which are currently locked up into highly appreciating, low income producing items and efficiently convert them to current income producing assets. This new or increased source of revenue is important to the retirement planning and the financial well-being of all Oregonians. The bill is also important to all charities. It will help stimulate additional new funds for the permanent endowments, again benefiting all Oregonians. If the federal estate tax is repealed, then this bill becomes even more important. It may help replace some of the estate tax incentives that have driven many of the charitable gifts that all charities have benefited in the past with an additional current income tax benefit. So, can we afford to drop the ball now? Do Oregonians have all the retirement income and services that are needed? I urge you to find a way to join together and support and pass this bill for the future of Oregon. Thank you. And what I'd like to do is spend the remainder of my few minutes to examine the example that's enclosed in the notes. This is a very simplified version of how this would work. So if a male, 65, female, 65, purchased a gift annuity with $35,000, the annuitant payout rate would be 6.6 or $2,300 a year of income for life. So that's the conversion. This creates a charitable income deduction of $9,800. Okay, so how the credit would work is it's a three-step process. The first step is its maximum credit cap of $10,000, so there's nothing above that. The other thing you have to look at is taking one half of the charitable deduction. So in this example, there would be eligible $4,900, and then you'd have to look at the actual current Oregon income tax liability, and it cannot exceed that. So in this example, these individuals are bringing or have a liability of $5,300. So the tax credit that would be applied here is $4,900. So you have to look at all three and choose the lowest of the three numbers. There's also no carry forward of any unused credit, and you also have to add back the federal deduction to Oregon for state income tax calculation.
All right. Thank you. Questions? Ladies and gentlemen. Yes, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, can you give us some examples of where you would envision this program being used? What types of institutions, organizations would be able to use this program to get more contributions?
Well, I think the answer is that we know there are 17,000 charities in the state of Oregon that are registered. Not all of them are set up through the state to issue gift annuities or pool funds. But most all of them can benefit through different ancillary relationships in the charitable trust business. So, conceivably, the benefit could be very far-reaching. On a practical basis, it's probably reasonable to assume that those religious and non-religious organizations alike that have been in business a while and have some sophistication or sense about these kinds of tools would be most advantaged by the credit.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. Did we run into a constitutional problem? I don't know if you were here for the previous discussion we had relative to contributions or tax credits for payments for educational expenses to religious institutions. Did we run into that problem here, and if not, why not? I'm not asking you to be a constitutional.
Yeah, I'm not a constitutional attorney. I think I'll pass. I was sort of bothered by where Representative Shetterly was going with this thinking about the whole idea.
Yeah, me too.
yeah. So I'd just as soon leave well enough alone on that and maybe ask.
Is there any current practice or legal opinion that you have that would give us some comfort level that this can be done and could be done, including with religious institutions, that wouldn't create an Oregon constitutional problem?
I'd like to address that, Chair.
Sure.
I think one of the things that when we modeled this piece of legislation, it was actually modeled out off an existing model that's in the state of Montana. Okay. So I think there's a little bit of credibility there. The other thing that's the difference between this and the tuition question that was just raised is in the tuition issue, the people that put out the tuition are getting a benefit. They're buying a service. Okay. Here, this money is actually released to the charity. It'd be just much like if you give $100 to your church, you're getting a deduction for that. You're not necessarily receiving a direct benefit for that. So I think those are two separate issues.
Interesting. I do note that you've got the representative, following up on Representative Witt's question, the members of the roundtable, and I see a lot of organizations there, many of which I'm sure, such as Oregon Food Bank, are not equipped to manage these. But you mentioned the ancillary services, and I guess that's right. You could give money to Oregon Community Foundation, for instance, and for a fee, they'll administer a planned gift for another charitable institution. Isn't that right?
That's right, Chair. Also, I might say that the Oregon Food Bank does have a gift annuity program. I advised them from a bit of a distance and helped them set up their gift annuity program recently, so the Oregon Food Bank, okay, in fact, would be a charity.
I thought I picked one that probably wouldn't.
Right. No, I think, again, through linkages with existing 501c3s or through growing capability on their own, this would have a broad impact for lots of charities.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Let's move on. Mr. Brooks, let's hear from you.
Thank you, Chairman Shetterly and members of the committee. My name is Stephen Brooks. I am a tax attorney, former tax attorney. I'm here representing basically myself. I worked in the estate planning area for approximately 10 years before doing something other than practicing law and started a nonprofit organization a couple of years ago. I am the only testifying, I guess, against this bill. My complaint is not against the idea of supporting charitable giving by the state, or that is to say, the state supporting charitable giving by individuals. It's the method in which the state chooses to make create that support. I think it's probably a truism to say that any tax incentive will increase giving. So the issue is, how do you best incentivize the kind of giving that's going to benefit the most charities? a charitable remainder trust and these other vehicles are very complex giving vehicles in comparison to other methods of making gifts. And so the question again is whether the state wants to essentially support financial planning on behalf of a relatively small number of givers as opposed to supporting direct giving by a larger percentage of the population. The ultimate effect of this bill will be to create more charitable remainder trusts, which is not the same thing as increasing giving within the community. The unfortunately, I only heard about this bill about a week and a half ago, and so I didn't have a lot of time to prepare materials. I made a very glaring typographical error on the last page of my one of the handouts, so please excuse the relative sloppiness of this material. The point that I really wanted to make, though, can be demonstrated. There's a handout that the first page says Taxpayer 1, the second page says Taxpayer 2, and what I'd like to do is just go through those two examples briefly and use them as a way to illustrate different concepts of giving. With Taxpayer 1, we have a taxpayer with about a $60,000 adjusted taxable income who has $50,000 of appreciated stock that they wish to make a gift with. If they create a charitable remainder trust, it will cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $2,000 to $5,000. It will generate approximately $3,500 a year in income. The donor obviously loses control over his assets by putting them in trust. He has given up those assets for all time, but he does retain the economic value of those assets. He'll generate about a $10,000 federal income tax deduction, which also currently applies at the state level. The money will not be distributed to a charity for a number of years. It remains in the trust until either the term of the trust ends or the donor, the beneficiary donor, dies. Under the House bill, given this kind of taxpayer, and again, this is I'm just estimating what their tax liability would be, but the donor would probably get a refund for all of the withholdings that they made during the year because the they would probably get a credit in the neighborhood of about $5,000, and that would cover the entire tax bill that they had for the year. If you go to Taxpayer 2 on the next page, and I think some of these were copied on two sides, so you may be on the back side of the front page. Take the same taxpayer with an adjusted taxable income of $60,000 with the $50,000 in stock, and they make a direct $10,000 gift of that stock to charity. It costs the donor, in this case, nothing to make that gift. It generates no taxable income to the donor. The donor gets $10,000 into the hands of a charity right away, so the charity has $10,000 that it can use. The donor can even either make a gift directly to the charity's endowment fund or to their operating budget. The donor still retains control over about $40,000 worth of their stock, which they can use to support their needs in whatever way they feel they wish. So if they actually have some kind of family emergency, they have access to the money. They still get their $10,000 federal and state income tax deduction, but under this House bill, they get no additional state tax benefit.
Well, let me say, though, I think if they made the gift to a permanent endowment held by an organization, they would. They don't have to set up a charitable remainder trust.
Well, the version of the bill that I read indicated that these were for charitable remainder trusts.
We have is that the dash twos?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, go ahead.
The idea, well, the concept is that in any vehicle where the donor is giving up current control over assets in exchange for an economic benefit over a period of time, the assets in that trust do not go to the use of the charity until after the period of income receipt by the donor ends. So in other words, regardless of who's holding those assets, if the donor is receiving income back, then those assets are not available to a charity until the donor stops receiving the income. So it's a deferred gift in that sense. But the real point is that under this House bill, you are providing a significant benefit to people making deferred gifts, but no benefit at all to people making direct gifts. So this only supports charitable giving in a very narrow sense. I'm not against charitable remainder trusts, but there are a significant number of organizations that do not have the sophistication or the economic resources to take advantage of charitable remainder trusts. The question then is this the best way for the state to encourage charitable giving? The question came up earlier, and this has come up in a couple of occasions, the issue of the tax credit and the expenditure of state dollars for a specific stated purpose. In this case, you're giving a tax credit to someone who's paying a significant amount of money to set up a charitable giving device and essentially compensating the donor for expenses in setting up a trust. In other words, the credit is not going to enhance giving, it's going to enhance the creation of a complicated trust creation or trust mechanism. It seems to me that what you're really doing is allowing the donor to recover the cost of creating a fairly complicated gifting mechanism rather than giving the donor an incentive to make a direct gift. The other issue, and I realize that my time is limited, but I would like to make one other point. This bill allows a credit in every year that a gift is made. Now, it is possible to create a charitable remainder trust. In fact, it happens fairly frequently where you can make multiple gifts. So I believe that this bill, the way it's drafted, encourages tax manipulation in the sense that it would be possible to, if you had a significant amount of stock, for example, to create a charitable remainder trust, put half of your stock in year one, and then the other half in year two, and get a $10,000 credit in each year. So you end up, the state ends up giving a total of $20,000 worth of credit in support of someone creating this gifting vehicle. And I'm not sure if that's what would be intended if this bill was passed. It's my understanding that, again, that the credit is given in each year that there is a gift made to one of these vehicles. It doesn't restrict someone, in other words, from deferring making a series of gifts in a number of years and getting the tax credit in each year that they make the gift. That is illustrated with taxpayer number 3, scenario B, where you have someone with a large holdings of stock. They create, say they have $500,000 worth of stock. They create their charitable remainder trust. It costs them about $5,000 to create it. They put half of their stock in the CRT in year one. They get their federal income tax deduction, which, by the way, carries forward for a 5-year period. And then they put the other $250,000 worth of stock into the trust in the following year. They get the $10,000 state tax credit in year one and year two, and in both cases, the tax credit is going to exceed the benefit they would have if they had just taken a regular income tax deduction. So in conclusion, I believe that while supporting charitable giving in the state is a very important goal, I'm not sure if this is the wisest use of the limited resources the state has in regard to supporting this kind of giving. I think that most charities would be better served by the state allowing direct giving rather than deferred giving and directing their incentives towards those kinds of gifts. I think the point was made by one of the gentlemen on the committee earlier. It is a relatively small number of nonprofits who have the resources to promote these kinds of programs, and as a result, it will benefit large nonprofits disproportionately to small nonprofits. I think I've covered all my points, and so I'd be happy to answer questions, or if I've used up too much time, I'm happy to.
Are there, we're running out. Are there questions for Mr. Brooks? Okay. We'll continue this conversation at a later time. I appreciate your perspective on the bill.
Thank you.
I want to bring up John Hawkins from Chemeketa Community College Foundation. Mr. Hawkins.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll be very brief. My name is John Hawkins. I'm with the Chemeketa Community College Foundation here in Salem. I'm the executive director. For the last 4 days, I spent time in another room in this building listening to good people on both sides of tables like these talk about the general fund budget for Oregon's 17 community colleges. The best part of those hearings was the testimony of community college students who told about the effect that a community college education has had on them. If I could, I would make those statements part of the record here today. Those students are feeling the impact of public dollars placed in the hands of local people who provide educational services to these students. And the changes evident in the students' lives have been enormous. House Bill 2492, the Endow Oregon Philanthropy Income Tax Credit you are considering today, makes it possible for people like me to provide college services to more Oregonians. Similarly, it allows development officers from other Oregon nonprofit organizations to help other Oregonians as well. How? Because it encourages some Oregonians to make planned gifts to Oregon nonprofits by giving these donors a tax credit. In the development world where I operate, we talk about social capital and personal capital. Personal capital is the money that we can spend as we choose, buy food, buy cars, insurance, and vacations. Social capital is that which we must give away, usually through taxes, to provide for the common good, to build roads, feed the hungry, defend our country, and educate our young people. Essentially, House Bill 2492 is a redistribution of social capital. It encourages Oregonians to move capital into the nonprofit sector where it can be used efficiently to help other Oregonians. And yes, it does take some capital away from the state's general fund through tax credits. But because planned gifts often convert inactive assets into life income arrangements, they also lead to increased income taxes, so the bill replaces some of the tax revenue it takes away. What you are considering here today is similar to what Congress is considering with the estate tax. Some form of repeal or reduction in estate taxes is probable, and this will mean a reduction in federal tax revenues, but it will keep more capital in the hands of Americans to direct as they choose. Some people believe repeal of the estate tax will hurt philanthropy. Others believe it will leave more capital in the hands of people who can then increase philanthropy. I don't know which point of view is correct. What I do know is that encouraging philanthropy puts more gifts, more capital, in the hands of nonprofit organizations that help disadvantaged Oregonians. This, I believe, is good public policy. Enactment of House Bill 2492 will encourage people in our state to be philanthropic, and I urge you to support and pass the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Briefly, if I could ask Mr. Bunn to come back forward on the dash twos. We have the dash one amendments, which came with the request of the John Mangus, I guess it was, to add public bodies to the recipients entitled qualified for this. And that dash one amendment includes a contribution to public body that's irrevocable or that otherwise qualifies. So that would not be an endowment gift. That would be just a straightforward contribution. And then would you explain the dash twos briefly?
As far as the, Chairman, as far as the, what we've tried doing with the amendments is actually limiting the deductions or the credit to those gifts that would provide an income stream that would provide income tax back to the state of Oregon. That was the major difference between what's happening here in Oregon and the Montana model.
Okay. So that the dash two do exclude direct contributions.
Right. As far as probing into the second set, the public entities, that was really done at a request. We have not had a chance to really totally explore how that would come about.
All right. I think we know what this is about then. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 2492? Okay. We'll close the public hearing on that. We've got a couple others with a very short witness list. I'd like to go ahead and finish the agenda. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2005. Actually, I think this will be our last one because Representative Beck has taken his leave. So, Ed and Lori, do you want to come on up while he's giving us the what for?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2005 creates an income tax credit for donations to Oregon higher education institutions, public and private non-sectarian schools, and to scholarship and student aid programs. The credit is 50% of eligible donations, up to $1,000 for joint filers, or $500 for non-joint filers, including corporations. Credit cannot exceed 50% of the taxpayer's tax liability before other credits are applied. The charitable deduction must be reduced by the amount of the credit taken, and non-resident personal income taxpayers can claim full credit without proration for their contributions. Credit is available beginning the 2002 tax year.
All right. Lori.
Good afternoon, Representative Shetterly and members of the committee. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen, Oregon Education Association, and you have my written testimony. Let me just say I could have signed up for about four of the five bills today and chose to put my name on one of them in opposition on behalf of my organization to tax cuts and tax breaks in the 2001 Legislative Assembly. However well-intentioned, the Oregon Education Association believes that the undesirable impacts of tax cuts right now exceed any benefits that might be realized by the programs. We have been a part of a coalition effort that you will all hear more about in the coming weeks to say, just say no to tax cuts. Fun fact to know and tell, this comes right out of the tax expenditure report. In 1997-99, Oregon gave away about 50 cents on the dollar, every tax dollar. We're now up to 54 cents on every tax dollar. That is to say that we fund core programs in Oregon with 46 cents on every tax dollar. That's out of the most recent tax expenditure report. At some point, we are shrinking our tax base to the point that fewer and fewer Oregonians are shouldering a greater and greater share of the tax burden for supporting those vital programs, including K-12 public education and community colleges. And all of you know, I don't need to lecture you, the crunch we're under with respect to funding those core programs in this session. And so with that said, tax credits in general, we are taking a just say no position, even with respect to Representative Beck's bill that would go explicitly to promote gifting to public education only. And that is because we can't be hypocrites. We feel that if it is the constitutional obligation of the state to fund education, that's where it ought to rest. We ought not be shifting the deck and having that be something that is increasingly more and more voluntary support obligation of private citizens and corporations. We also, of course, have concerns about the bills that explicitly refer to money being routed to private education. As it has been stated before, with respect to House Bill 2005, especially, we believe that that would be unconstitutional without HDR 2, but we oppose HDR 2, of course, because let's be clear, it's the V word. It is vouchers. It's by another name, but the Oregon Education Association has long been opposed to the vouchers for private education because they undermine public school funding, in our opinion, which hurts all children. Finally, we believe that the stimulation of gifting, unfortunately, has dramatically been advanced by the decade of disinvestment in public education we've experienced since the passage of ballot Measure 5. I'm not sure we need any more encouragement. I know there are a lot of folks who are allies in the business community among individuals, parents, and other citizens who have very generously contributed to education foundations associated with public schools. And while we're grateful for that, we still assert that the financing of public education is a public responsibility through our the money we pool through our tax dollars. Finally, we believe that the key and most pressing problems facing public education have to do with the long-term overall adequacy and stability of Oregon's tax code and with respect to school funding. We know that reducing class size, repairing school facilities, fully funding special education programs for targeted populations, getting resources to small schools into the high-growth areas that are burgeoning and busting at the seams. Those are some of the most critical problems in this building, and none of these bills address those. And so we would ask that this committee resist the temptation to see these tax credits as a substitute fix. We figure it's only going to exacerbate the problem.
Okay. Any questions? Bob Bisanio. Thank you, Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Bob Castagna, General Counsel and Executive Director of the Oregon Catholic Conference. The conference represents the Catholic bishops of Oregon and service to the Catholic population of, in Oregon of more than 300,000 people. I'd just like to put on the record... I'd just like to put on the record some factual information that the committee may not be aware of. In the Catholic school population alone, we educate nearly 15,000 students in 9 high schools and 45 elementary schools, 54 schools throughout the state of Oregon. Take whatever figure the committee would like to use as the average cost of educating a student in the state of Oregon. In past sessions, it was $6,000. I don't know if it's more than that now. I don't know if we're closer to $6,507. But even if you took the $6,000 figure, the Catholic schools alone save this state in a magnitude in excess of $90 million a year. That's just the Catholic schools alone in terms of educational costs. We consider that a gift that the Catholic community and the parents that send their children to Catholic schools provide to the state of Oregon in terms of reduced costs. I'm here today to testify on House Bill 2005, but asking if this legislation is to be advanced, that it be extended to include private sectarian educational programs, which would be in line with House Joint Resolution 2. We testified before this committee earlier this week in favor of the refundability of the Earned Income Tax Credit and the Working Family Child Care Credit. And our priorities for this session remain maintaining the safety net of state programs for vulnerable persons, and also, to the extent that we can, seeking tax equity for the poor. We didn't come advancing or requesting that this legislation be introduced this session, but if this committee were to advance tax credits for educational contributions, there is a parity right now that exists with respect to contributions to both private schools and public schools, in that a tax deduction is equally available to contributions to both private and public education. And we would see it as only a matter of the most fundamental fairness and justice, particularly in light of what we save the state of Oregon through the contribution of our private schools, that if the legislature were to advance to tax credit contributions or contributions to education, that injustice be equally extended to contributions to private and public schools. And we would take a most contrary view to the previous witness. In no way do we consider this a voucher program. These are contributions. These are tax credits. It might be politically expedient to attach a voucher label, but in no way is it considered a voucher program.
Okay, thank you, Bob. Any questions? All right. Does anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 2005? If not, I'll close the public hearing on that. And just while we have it on the agenda, we're not going to have any testimony on it, but just so we've got it in case we ever need to come back to it, let me open a public hearing on House Bill 3141. And if you can just read its summary, and we'll do this as a tap-tap.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3141 creates an income tax credit for donations to nonprofit entities organized to assist public schools. The credit is 100% of eligible contributions up to $1,000 for joint filers, or $500 in the case of non-joint filers and corporations. Charitable deduction must be reduced by the amount of the credit taken. Non-resident personal income taxpayers can claim full credit without proration, and credit would become available beginning 2002 tax year.
Okay, thank you. Close public hearing on House Bill 3141. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you, everybody. Have a good weekend.